Sometimes nature plays tricks on us, and we imagine we are something other than what we truly are. Is this a key to life in general, or the case of the two-headed schizophrenic? Both heads thought the other was following itself. Finally, when one head wasn't looking, the other shot the other right between the eyes and, of course, killed himself.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to this, the latest episode of the Rewatch Project with Hannah and Mike out of Wellington, New Zealand. I am Mike, and with me, as always, is Hannah. How are you this Saturday evening?
It is a bit like that, isn't it? What day is it today? I'm well, thank you very much. And you?
Very good, very good. Looking forward to watching an episode of Twin Peaks, the fifth episode of season two. Do you want to tell us a little bit about what we're going to be talking about this evening, Hannah?
Tonight's episode is called The Orchid's Curse. It is directed by Graham Clifford and written by Barry Pullman. Synopsis says, Cooper remembers the message under his bed. Shelley and Bobby begin Leo's home care. Sternwood hears pretrial motions and declares Leo not fit for trial. Nadine comes home still thinking she's in high school.
Barry Pullman, you know, worked on loads of shows. Twin Peaks obviously being one of them, Roswell, a lot of genre shows. Let's have a little bit of a look about Graham Clifford, shall we?
Known for Don't Look Now.
Okay. He didn't direct Don't Look Now, though. That was Nicholas Rogue. So he must have been a cinematographer or an editor, maybe, I'm guessing. Graham Clifford, director. Let's have a look.
He was the editor for Don't Look Now.
Yeah.
And the Rocky Horror Picture Show.
Oh, wow. Gosh. Okay, so.
The Man Who Fell to Earth, The New Avengers.
Yeah. Australian filmmaker. Postman
Always Rings Twice.
Well, he was his primary collaborator was Robert Altman, who worked on MASH and McCabe and Mrs. Miller. It's funny, one thing that I've been kind of trying to remember to mention is that the director of last week's episode, Todd Holland, he directed a few episodes of Twin Peaks. I think that's his name anyway. Let me just double check. Sorry, I'm being computer boy today. I knew when we were watching an episode that it triggered some recent memory.
Mm.
Do you know what else he directed?
What?
Monster High 1 and 2.
Oh, my goodness.
Films that are very present in our lives.
Extremely present.
Via our 9-year-old daughter.
Here I am, I'm coming out of the dark.
They're musical films, and that song's from it, just in case you thought Hannah was having a stroke there. So, yeah, it is interesting to see what these people go on to do, and that is a bit of a curveball to think that the guy who, you know, directed incredible scenes like Leland's breakdown and that crazy surreal shock through the wall at the beginning of the episode also directed the two Monsters High movies. So, wow.
Artistic endeavors in their own right.
Yes, absolutely. Everything has its place. So I just wanted to mention that. A couple of quick bits of housekeeping before we talk about the episode. First and foremost, we always appreciate feedback. One of the motivators for podcasting is opening up a dialogue with your audience. And it's tricky as well because, you know, Twin Peaks is a show that you can kind of blast through. And I think the nature of our podcast as well is every time we finish a show, we're essentially starting a new podcast when we come back as yeah. well. But if you are along for the ride, and even if you do discover this episode somewhere in the future, our future at least, your present listener, that's obviously how time works. Well, we are getting talking about David Lynch stuff tonight.
So uncomplicated.
Yeah. don't worry about feeling like you've missed the boat. Please do still send us yeah. feedback, and you can do so at rewatchprojectpodcast@gmail.com, and you can also leave comments on our YouTube channel. If that's how you listen to the show, we'll read those out as feedback if we feel that it's appropriate to do so. And also please do check out our friend shows, namely my other podcast, Chinstroker versus Punter, as well as Film Bastards, The Good, the Bad and the Odd, the Talk Without Rhythm podcast, His Film, Her Movie and Video Game Landfill, and also reviews on Spotify and on Apple Podcasts are equally appreciate it.
Did you say the good, the bad, you, and the odd?
I did, yeah. You can also reach out to us via social media on at RewatchProj and on Twitter and on Instagram. That is the same handle there. So, Hannah, anything for us on this edition?
Indeed. Silver Surfer says,
hey, beautiful.
Greetings, my fellow agents. Just wanted to say hello and drop you another comment. I'm doing okay, surviving in this crazy cosmos. Twin Peaks wasn't a show I got into much, but did enjoy the film Fire Walk With Me. Thanks, Silver Surfer. Hopefully you plan to revisit some of Twin Peaks maybe, or watch Fire Walk With Me with us again. Yeah.
Well, I mean, that I assume he's responding to what we said on the last episode.
Yeah,
so,
I guess so.
So,
yeah.
I mean, I would say that if you are, I would imagine if you are listening to this that you are watching along. If not, then, you know, have at it.
Yeah.
I can't imagine watching Fire Walk With Me without the context of the show, because the thing about Fire Walk With Me is there are so many characters who are only in it because they were in the show. And there's these entire scenes that don't really contribute to the storyline of the film. They're just there as sort of vignettes for fans of the show.
Yeah.
So I'd be very curious to see what somebody would make of that from that context. So
Feedback, Silver Surfer, bring it on.
But if you are watching the show, let us know what you think. I can't imagine what watching Twin Peaks for the first time in 2024 would be like. So, give us insight.
We also have two YouTube comments from Julie, a new feedbacker.
Cool.
Welcome, Julie. She says, watching in Australia, I watched the original as it aired. I was 28, hooked from the start. Also watched season 3 as it aired. How brilliant. My husband and I rewatched seasons 1 and 2, then Fire Walk With Me, then Missing Pieces, leading up to season 3. What an amazing few months.
And that's what we'll be doing. I think the only thing we're going to be doing differently, and people might say that this is heresy because it's essentially a fan edit, but what I think we'll probably do is watch, season 1 and 2 and then the extended cut of Fire Walk With Me, which is essentially the same as watching Fire Walk With Me and then the missing pieces, but we're just watching it as one thing.
Yeah.
I doubt we'll be watching it in one go and recording the podcast that night.
100%
no. I think a 3.5 or 3 hours, 40-minute movie and a podcast is, unless our children suddenly decide to move out, that won't be happening.
Putting it into context, it's 8:45. Our children, well, one child's asleep, one child is absolutely not asleep.
Yeah. We may as well invite her to be a co-host on the podcast at this point. So what did you think of season 5, episode 2 of Twin Peaks, Chloe? Why do you make me watch this weird stuff? There are no songs in it or unicorns.
Very scared.
Yeah.
You said it's the same director. she also goes on to say, my son has Asperger's. Lynch is definitely the same.
Yeah, well, that's interesting to hear because, I mean, I am in no way qualified to say that. And I think that when I think of Asperger's and when I say somebody seems to have those traits, I am very much saying that as a lay person and I'm kind of, but, you know, it's, I do think that there were a lot of people with that persona in the 80s. And I think it was before David Byrne's another person that I often think of that, you know, where I think if they were coming up now, that would be, part of the narrative.
That neurodivergent label.
Yeah, whereas back then people were you were just quirky art types.
Yeah.
You know?
I think a lot can be said for a neurodivergent look on life because it creates different perspectives and interesting ways of looking at the world. And, you know, lots of varied creativity.
Well,
we all thought and felt the same way about things, you would never have diversity of media.
Well, it's diversity in the purest sense of the word, isn't it? Because I think the word diversity has become sanitized and kind of buzzworded out of me.
Well, it's become very...
it's a HR term.
But a loaded word.
Yes, exactly. And but really, ultimately, what it means is variety, is different views of the universe. And that's not, we don't necessarily mean, and again, that's taken on political meanings. But what I mean by that is views of the world from a storytelling perspective.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, for example, what David Lynch brings to a lot of his thing is the idea that narrative isn't the most important thing.
Yeah.
And in the overwhelming majority of entertainment, it is.
Yeah.
The idea that feeling and mood is more important than narrative or even character in often.
Yeah.
You know, and that's a perspective that I think most people wouldn't bring.
It's like directors who bring colour to the forefront of their films rather than... that's their main thing.
Yeah.
It's linked to
Wes Anderson or somebody like that.
It's all about the intricate dialogue. Think of Tarantino with his great big long monologues and things like that.
And then you've got, people talk about David Lynch being an auteur, and he is, but he's not really a writer. You know, I mean, if you think about the great film directors.
It's more about the vibe.
But I mean, Alfred Hitchcock, Steven Spielberg, neither of them are writers.
Mm.
You know, Stanley Kubrick, you know, a lot of these people weren't writers. I mean, David Lynch said, David Lynch, George Lucas, you know, a lot of these great filmmakers see writing as this horrible thing that they've got to subject themselves
to.
To do that. But no, great to hear from you, Julie. That's awesome stuff. And
keep the comments coming.
Yeah, keep them coming. Cool. Are we good to go?
We're good.
All right, then. We're going to hit pause. We're going to watch episode 5, The Orchid's Curse, season 5 of season 2 of Twin Peaks. And then we will return and tell you what we thought about it.
See you soon. Be right back.
Good afternoon, good morning, good evening, and welcome to Film Bastards, a podcast where three friends, two of them married and two of them podcasting life partners, chat everything from new releases, trailers, news, and an eclectic mix of other film goodies. Oh, and many, many, many tangents. You can find them by searching your podcast provider or check them out on Twitter and Instagram by searching Film Bastards. You never know, you might like it. And if you don't, well, we don't really give a f***.
And we are back. So we have just finished watching episode 5 of season 2 of Twin Peaks. So Hannah, before we get into our breakdown, as we do, do you have any initial thoughts that you would like to air here?
I feel like this is the episode when everyone sneaks around and steals things to make life better.
It is very sneaky, sneaky,
isn't it? The sneaky, sneaky episode of Twin Peaks.
Yeah.
sneaky Twin Peaks.
Yeah, Sneaky Peaks. I mean, there's quite a lot of sneaking around in Twin Peaks in general, though, isn't there? I mean, it's quite a defining element of the show, I would say.
Yeah, absolutely.
Any other thoughts beyond the sneakiness that ensued?
Yes, if Martin Short and Matthew Modine were to make Sweet Sweet Love, Lenny Von Dolan is who they would create.
Yeah, he looks like a lot of people.
I really enjoyed it, and I like it's quite satisfying having an episode where they kind of the good guys get one over the bad guys.
Yes.
You know, they
it doesn't happen a lot in Twin Peaks, does it really?
You know, they rescue Audrey and you can't really say the same about old Donna and Maddie.
No, but there's a lot of proactivity from our protagonists.
Proactivity. Yeah, that's a good one. I really enjoyed it. I thought it had a really nice mix of action and exposition.
Yeah.
Yeah. What about you?
No, I agree. I mean, there's a lot of stuff happens. A lot of, you know, there is action. And I don't mean action in the Jerry Bruckheimer sense of the word, but, you know, action in the sense of, well, proactivity, things mm-hmm. happening, people doing things. But also, there are some really nice, to use the word again, sort of vignettes, some scenes, you know, some of those great kind of syrupy scenes that Twin Peaks does where things slow down and you kind of enter into a bit of a dream space with characters. There's a couple mm-hmm. of sequences like that. Like we've talked before about, like, for example, you know, Audrey in the diner in the early parts of season one, kind of losing herself in the music. You know, yeah. you've got scenes like when Donna is recounting that episode from her adolescence with Laura to Harold. Yeah. That's a great Twin Peaks, just a character getting lost in memory and kind of drifting off into this kind of psychic ether, mm. you know. And also, I think that this is just a really nice looking episode. There's a lot. It's just a very from a pure cinematographical perspective.
Yeah,
it's a really nice looking episode for, you know, a guest director. There's a lot to be said, and there's a lot of memorable moments in this episode as well. I just feel that this is quintessential Twin Peaks, because it's funny when people talk about Twin Peaks, a lot of the time their mind goes to the intensely Lynchian stuff. Yeah. People think of, like, the little man, they think of Bob, they think of the Black Lodge. Mm. But I think of, like, people sitting around, you know, I think of James having his dinner in the diner mm. and Maddie coming in and having a conversation. I think of those kind of smaller.
You are in love with James.
But what I mean, though, is I think of those smaller moments of just, I mean, I would be perfectly happy if nothing happened in Twin Peaks and we literally just followed the lives of the characters in the ambience of the town. I mean, for example, I mean, there are these YouTube channels that I follow that there's quite a few of them, and they're like geek ambience channels. So they're things like, I'll put some on, like Chloe watches, so our daughter watches some of them sometimes, where it'll be things like 4 hours of Gryffindor Christmas ambience, you know, where it's like, you know, when people have like log fire videos on and things, it's like that. It's where you'll have like relaxing score and there'll be usually a moving image as well, like an animated thing that's kind of on a loop. Mm. And the idea is it's kind of like, it's like a, like almost like what, how you would use a lava lamp or a fireplace,
it's,
you know.
ASMR.
Yeah, exactly. Mm. And there's Twin Peaks ones. There's like the diner with rain against it, but with the score like clicking, you know, underneath it. And part of my enjoyment of Twin Peaks is almost that ASMR-ishness of it.
Mm.
And that's why, you know, when a lot of people are critical of the, you know, the perceived excesses of the latter part of season two, I'm not bothered, because I just want to be in the town.
Yeah.
You
want to be in that world for as long as possible.
Yeah, and that's one of the appeals of certainly the original Twin Peaks is just being enveloped by that world.
Mm.
And I think that this episode is a really good one of that, where you get to see a lot of the town. You get to see a lot of places in this episode that you don't normally see. There's some really nice, it's like a really inconsequential thing to say, but these are the things I think you notice when you rewatch things a lot. And particularly when you're seeing something that's had a significant upgrade in visual fidelity.
Yeah.
Is there's a lot of unique establishing shots in this episode. Like, there's a shot of the Great Northern from its car park at sunset that we haven't seen before.
It's beautiful as well.
And you really get to see around One Eye Jack's, this kind of ridiculous, yep. sumptuous Kubrickian red space that they're in. You know, you see.
And how kind of makeshift and seedy.
Yeah, like you see like paint cans and things, just, you know, you see the roadhouse during the day. And I just feel like, and I love that stuff. And if you're a geek, you do. It's like, for example, I was listening to a Star Wars podcast the other day, and they were talking about something that I really enjoyed as well, is the in Return of the Jedi, the Star Wars film, you go to Jabba the Hutt's palace and, you know, you see it. And I've seen that film, God, hundreds of times, you know, saw it at the cinema, video, television, just over and over and over again. I know that film inside out. And then in the TV series, The Book of Boba Fett, they go back to that environment and spend several episodes there. And the joy of that to a hardcore geek is you're like, oh, I've always wondered what was round that corner or what was on the other side of that bar. And to see something that you've seen so many times, but from a different angle, is always a really interesting thing. And I think that on some weird level, this episode does that a little bit. Well, should we get into it? Should we break it down?
Yeah, let's go for it.
All righty. So we open up with Cooper waking in room 315 of the Great Northern. The saga of the earplugs is still going on, where we see that he talks about how he dreamt that he was, chewing a tasteless, was it a marshmallow or
something? Gumdrop,
that was it. But he was actually chewing on the earplug that Diane had sent him to block out the Norwegians. We see that Hawk updates them on Pearl Lakes, but it doesn't sound like what Leland said is accurate. That there's no Robertson or wasn't any Robertson leasing the house.
What is in what he's saying to Diet?
No. Oh, sorry. Yeah. Well, I've skipped. Sorry.
You skipped quite a lot there.
Well, I've skipped a shot where Cooper sees.
But he finds the note.
Yeah. He finds the note under the bed. That was the thing that he'd forgotten. Mm. We get a sequence with a Mr. Pinkle demonstrating the hardware that they're going to use for Leo, that Bobby and Shelley are going to use.
Because of course, I always quite enjoy how old-fashioned the wheelchair is that they have.
Yeah.
Like how it's sort of rattan and rattan, that kind of like woven fabric.
Oh, okay.
And just looks like something directly out of the 1800s rather than, you know, I suppose it adds to the indistinguishable time frame that it is. It just always tickles me when I see it because it's so antiquated.
Yeah, it's not a piece of 1990.
No.
Medical technology.
No.
So, I mean, they've got their insurance scam going on where the idea is that they're going to live off Leland, off Leo, sorry.
And Shelley's just really not into it.
Yeah.
But being Shelley, she's going along
with it, yeah, because that's what she does.
Whatever her other half wants.
But I love that there's two quintessential sort of Twin Peaks-y Lynchian things in this scene, although, again, of course, Lynch didn't direct this episode, but you know, his style sort of permeates the show. One is the fascination with contraptions, and particularly contraptions failing or misfiring. Yeah. Like, you know, you think about the coffin pulley misfiring. And also Mr. Pinkle he's another one in a long line of ineffective kind of little men. Like Emery Battis is one of those as well. And that's a recurring type that you see a lot in Twin Peaks as well. There's more of those to come as well. And also, you know, it's just the way that Pinkle's just kind of he's just a nervous, twitchy guy. Like when the machine's not working, he's like, you've got to hit it, you've got to treat it like a woman. And it's just kind of like, oh, you know, this survivor of domestic abuse is here. It's like you probably need to work on that a little bit. So we go over to the roadhouse, and I've got to say here, actually, there's one thing that I occasionally hear in Twin Peaks fandom that always bugs me, and I don't know why. This is one of those hating it when people call them Legos, not Lego kind of thing. And I'm sorry, Mark, from The Good, The Bad, and The Odd of the Twin Peaks log, because I know that this is something that he says, is people who refer to the roadhouse as the Bang Bang Bar. It's the roadhouse. Nobody says the words Bang Bang Bar out loud ever in Twin Peaks. Now, I get the fact that you see the sign and that's the bar within the roadhouse, but it's the roadhouse. Everybody calls it the roadhouse. And every time Mark would go the Bang Bang Bar on the podcast, I just wanted to scream. So just wanted to get that out there. And I know that, and occasionally I'll see that. Somebody,
I think you need to try meditation if that makes you scream.
Well, no, I think what that shows actually is that I obviously am pretty chill about everything in life, because if that's the kind of silly thing that I'm having to get my, you know, get my rocks off to, then I obviously, you know, have to put that impulse somewhere. But what's happening here is this is the pre-trial for Leland, and also later on we'll see.
Why is it held at the Roadhouse as well?
Because it's a tiny town, and they obviously don't have. I mean, for the same reason that they have a traveling judge who goes around all of these small towns. Because one of the things about Twin Peaks is on the opening credits, it says 51,231 is the population. That was forced on them by ABC. It was meant to be 5,300, and but they had to move the comma to pacify the town. But then in, and I've brought this with me today because I've mentioned this on the podcast before. This is the tourist guide for Twin Peaks, by the real company that do the tourist guides.
Why have you brought that to an audio format where no one can see?
Well, I am actually going to film it and put it in the that. But basically what we've got here is, hang on, let me just hold this up. So this is the Welcome to Twin Peaks, the access guide to Twin Peaks, written by Mark Frost and David Lynch. But it was produced by the same company that do the real access guides to towns. And I bought this in, hang on, let's have a look at the date. And there's two things in this episode that are referenced in this. In 1991, and this is crazy, it's got a map of the town. It's got loads of Major Briggs's documents all blacked out. You've got like the portions of the phone book. You've got the history of the town. You've got the public transport timetables. All of the phone numbers and addresses of everywhere in the town that you can go for dining. You've got recipes. But what you've got the history of the town, flora and fauna.
Oh my God.
Of the town. And again, this was written by Mark Frost and David Lynch. They sat down and created this entire thing.
Amazing.
Also about local businesses. So, I mean, the fact that they actually, you know, David Lynch only directed, I think, 3 or 4 episodes in season 2, but had the time
to write a book.
To do this. And in this, they actually say that there was a printing error on the town sign.
Right.
And that the population is actually 5,000, and it was 321 as opposed to 53,200. And basically, that was their way of surreptitiously getting across to the fans, because the show was still on the air when this came out.
Yeah.
That wasn't the case. And the other thing that it's got is it's got how to mix a little blackie, you know, those drinks
that
they have in the Roadhouse. It's got...
What is it?
I'll look at it another time, because I was trying to find it earlier on, but I couldn't find the page. But that's in there, as well as the actual recipe, the real recipe that the actual diner in Twin Peaks, the real one, has for cherry pie, which David Lynch tried and loved and then wrote into the show as well. So it's a fascinating read. But I love the fact that that's such a Lynchian piece of expanded universe, not a novel.
Yeah.
Like, there's no Twin Peaks novels or comic books. There's diaries and there's, you know, weird, I guess, ephemera is probably the word like that. But I wanted to mention that because this episode's the first one where I reckon they were probably putting this together around this time, because there seems to be a lot of stuff from around this point in the series feeding into this. But it's a really fascinating read, and it really expands the canon of the show.
Ooh.
And they refer to it as the Roadhouse as well in there, I should mention. No mention of frigging Bang Bang Bar or Legos.
I'm going to call it the Bang Bang Bar now, just to piss you off.
They're trying to get bail for Leland. Ben is there watching half-interestedly, you know, like absent-mindedly. And as soon as, you know, the decision's made, he just leaves, you know.
Yeah.
I like how, and this is a little touch I've never noticed before, how affectionately Cooper is looking at Truman when Truman is vouching for Leland.
Yeah.
In there.
But don't you think that goes against how Cooper was in the previous episode?
No, because this isn't about that moment's not about what about Leland and whether Cooper agrees. It's about what Cooper is witnessing about Truman's character.
Mm. I just thought it was interesting that he looked favourable when Truman's, you know, vouching for Leland and how no one can know how the grief of a child will affect you, yeah, when he basically shot that down.
Yeah, but the difference there is that what in that scene that you just described, Truman was almost trying to explain away, it's in Cooper's eyes, what Leland had done. In this scene, Truman's not offering any editorializing.
No, in the other scene, yeah. It was Doc Hayward.
That's what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
He was basically saying that, you know, God, well, you know, can we really blame him? I mean, what an awful thing to have happened. Mm. In this scene, Truman isn't offering any opinion on the morality of what Leland's done.
Mm.
He's just talking about how he's viewed in about his character, historically.
Mm.
So whereas I think that if Truman was saying, hey, you know, my feeling is that we should go easy on him because of this terrible thing that's happened, I think that would be different.
Yeah.
But that was something that I noticed that I hadn't noticed before. Donna agrees to tell Harold her story as part of his living novel if he lets her read Laura's diary. She originally wanted to, she wanted to read it, and he said that he will, his compromise is that he will let, he will read it to her because he doesn't want it to leave the house. And I like I've always liked the line about how when she says there's things you can't get in a book, and he's like, there's things you can't get anywhere.
Yeah.
You know, and she tries to get him outside. And this is another great kind of bit of Twin Peaks ambiguity is obviously on the one hand, you could just say that he's got, mental health issue. It's preventing him from going outside.
It's almost like he's allergic to UV.
Well, yeah. Or some kind of physical reaction or even, and again, I think that because of his proximity to, these sort of threshold characters, the old lady, is it Mrs. Tremond and her grandson, you know, I've always felt that there's something more to Harold, that he is in some way connected to
these, that sort of otherworldly.
Yeah,
kind of
yeah. Or at least I think because, you know, his world is so insular and, you know, liminal, I think that it feels that he is right on the sort of the city limits of where things, maybe reality is a little bit, you know, thin. Mm. I think it's, at the very least, I think that they're playing with the idea that he can't go outside because it's almost like it would almost be like a holodeck character leaving the holodeck.
Mm.
You know, they wouldn't be able to exist out there, you know.
Yeah.
That's kind of what it feels like to me. The lawyer that we see in the Leo case is played by a guy called Van Dyke Parks, and he's a really interesting guy because he's a artist, very famous artist and musician from the 60s.
What a name.
Yeah, well, he collaborated.
Is that his real name?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, he collaborated with with Brian Wilson on the classic Beach Boys albums in the 60s. Like, he produced those, and he worked with like Frank Zappa and Captain Beefheart.
This is the guy who played the prosecutor.
The old guy, the white haired guy with the mustache, not the Darrell Lodwick, not the
redneck guy. One.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. The smaller, older guy. And you know, the one who's standing up there with the photographs of Leo.
Oh, right, yeah.
And he even in his later career, like worked with U2 and things like that. He's a great fringe, counterculture kind of cult figure. So the casting of him in there is interesting because it just adds to Twin Peaks' kind of, I hate to use the term, but kind of indie cred a little bit. The fact that when they bring in guest actors, they're bringing in kind of really interesting people who, and I'd never heard of Van Dyke Parks when I watched the show, but then I looked into it and I went down a bit of a rabbit hole, and that got me into like Captain Beefheart and a lot of these kind of 60s.
But you can say that as well for what I call season three, with you know, the musical interludes that they have and stuff. Like, they don't go with, you know, whatever is the latest craze. They go with
people who feel right.
Yeah, it's very much a, like, they've got a certain style.
Yeah, yeah.
And feeling to it, and
like David Bowie, they being really Fire Walk With
they
Me,
really you know? Do have quite amazing taste when it comes to that kind of art and music scene.
Yeah, and they're not all the same. I mean, in some way, I mean, you look at season
three. No, they're very different.
You've got like people like Au Revoir Simone and the Chromatics, who are very electronic, and then you've got like, you know, country
Nine
singers,
Inch Nails, and
you know, who, and people who, but they all feel like they exist in the same world.
Mm.
You know, the judge take Truman and Cooper to talk about what they think about the trial. And it's funny because a couple of interesting things happen in the scene. Do you notice how Cooper doesn't touch his drink?
Yeah.
He just sort of looks at it perplexed.
I kind of wished that that when Truman gets up off his chair, he kind of stumbled, or like the drink sort of got to his knees or something.
And it's
would
such
be quite
a,
fun.
It's such an interesting looking drink as well, because it's like, it's literally half black and half white on the top, isn't it?
It's like Sheridan's.
Yeah.
That's making a comeback thanks to TikTok.
Oh, really? Oh, well.
Classic 90s drink.
We have to give thanks to TikTok. But and also the fact that Cooper says that he's been there for 12 days.
Yeah.
That's a reminder. And particularly watching the show in real time.
Yeah.
You know, back in the day, you know, with a gap between the seasons, and you were like, wow, yeah, 12 days. That's like, you know, I mean, that's like two episodes ago in real time. You know. They decide that Leo is not competent to stand trial.
And it's also, like, kudos to him. He is one hairy motherfucker.
What, Leo?
Yeah.
It's interesting.
He's got quite the chest on him.
It's also interesting that the judge tells Cooper to keep an eye on the woods.
Mm.
You know, he says that there's ancient stuff going on there. Nadine doesn't recognise James. And it just occurred to me in this episode, of course, James lives there.
Yeah.
And because I was thinking, does he? And then I'm like, well, where does James live? And then I think there's twice maybe in the whole show.
Bike, man, he's part of the road.
There's twice in the show that you see him around there. There's the once when he refuses to go to where he turns up full of pain and doesn't want to go to Laura's funeral.
No one understands, man.
No, they don't. And then there's this episode, but he's never around, obviously, because he's on the road.
Yeah.
Dealing
with his pain.
But it is funny to think that James lives there.
Yeah. Probably got a sad single bed.
Yeah, yeah. Black room, painted black.
Where he can sit and strum his guitar and think about his pain.
Yeah, and singing his unnerving falsetto.
So much pain.
The Nadine rips off the fridge door after a number of non sequiturs about thinking she's still back in high school.
I did think that she reminded me quite a lot of our son, because he breaks things really easily, and it's just, well, it just happened.
Just came off in my hand.
It just came off in my hand.
He's the victim.
Yeah.
When he smashes his Lego up that I've spent hours making.
As he breaks our third TV, you know.
He just got in the way of the brick I threw. It's, who'd have known?
It's just crazy.
We see Tajimara-san put in an offer for Ghostwood that catches Ben's attention. It's so funny. $5 million.
I wouldn't sniff at it.
Well, no, but I mean, it's not like a...
It's not a life-changing sum of money.
Shockingly generous land deal. I mean, we see Cooper blowing his duck whistle as he goes on his way to see. And I love how sort of just comedically clandestine things are getting now, like the way that Ben's got that little doorway that Hank just seems
to
live in.
That scene when Cooper's walking down the hallway with his duck whistle and... like, you've seen Bobby beforehand and Hank before him, you know, they're all very, you know, it's almost like a dance. How
one
and then one pops out and then Cooper, you know, it's just really well done.
Yeah, the show does that
really
a few
like
times
that.
Actually. I mean, and a lot of shows would use that technique in, you know, like in The West Wing was famous for the walk and talk, you know, and you would, two characters would branch off and then you'd go with another one.
Yeah.
And Ben says to Hank that Cooper isn't coming back and asks him to bring Audrey and the briefcase back if possible. And then I love the way that when Hank goes, he's essentially immediately goes back to the $5 million check as well. Like you can really see where his priorities are there as well. I love all the scenes where Donna and Maddie are plotting things, how they're always shot with both of their faces really close to each other in a frame.
Yeah.
And it just adds to that kind of Nancy Drew kind of girls getting into trouble and kind of whispering and being mischievous kind of feeling.
I'm such a mother, though. My first thought was, gosh, I hope one of them doesn't have nits.
Wow. We see Andy on the front desk. He's a whole damn town. And again,
he is a whole damn town.
Harry's just like, oh, good. You know, doesn't care enough to ask, but, you know.
I love the fact that he's just covered in post-it notes and no one bats an eyelid at it.
Yeah. I also love how patient the maternal woman on the phone is.
Yeah.
She's like, very good, sir.
Very good.
Yeah, she just talks to him like he's a child. We see Truman and Cooper looking at a map of One-Eyed Jack's. Mm-hmm. Hawk walks in to tell them that he's found the one-armed man's drug, but not him. And how this drug has a weird, deep smell. And they're waiting for Albert to get back to them with the toxicology on that. And you see Hawk kind of look at them suspiciously, foreshadowing what will happen later on in the episode as well.
He knows that they're hiding something.
And it's funny, I mean, to go back to the whole sneaky peek thing, the same thing happens in the very next scene with Maddie and James.
Yeah.
Where, you know, he can tell that there's something going on there as well.
Yeah, there's no way she's buying a takeaway coffee for her uncle.
Yeah, and I love the idea that, you know, you think of the diner as being this cool 50s place, but, you know, James has gone there for like an evening like pot roast, like sat at the at the desk. It's just James gets blown off at the diner by Maddie, which
not sucked off down a hole.
No. we see Donna tell Harold the story of Laura and the boys at the lake. And I think this is kind of the eye of the duck scene in this episode, in the way that this is the slowest, longest, kind of most hypnotic scene. It's largely done in one take.
Mm.
And it's funny because one of the things that I like about this scene, there's a couple of things that I like about this scene. I think it's really well acted.
Mm.
I think it's beautifully shot as well. Like, I think that it's really tastefully filmed and it really draws you in and there's great storytelling there. But the other thing as well is that does feature in The Secret Diary of Laura Palmer, which came out during season one. So this, when this episode was on, I did the prototype Leonardo DiCaprio pointing meme.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, I remember this from The Secret Diary of Laura Palmer. So it kind of canonized that moment.
Yeah.
And there's a bit of chicken and egg there because Jennifer Lynch wrote The Secret Diary of Laura Palmer. So obviously, you know, David Lynch was, you know, probably, you know, probably read it. It was like, you know, if your daughter wrote a tie-in book based on a TV show you created, you'd probably read it, wouldn't you?
Of course you would.
You know, or probably have been somewhat involved as well, I'd imagine. But it's interesting that when they got to the point in the show where they were like, okay, we have to have Donna tell a story about her and Laura that predated the show, they just went, well, let's just get something from The Secret Diary of Laura Palmer and do that. So it is not, that's, I always liked that moment for that reason, is that it kind of legitimized
great continuity,
that extra little bit. And it's, the names of the characters are all exactly the same, but the book came first. So, you know, the fact that they were taking from that meant that this thing that I was geeking out about actually had some validity to it, you know, which is kind of important when you're looking at expanded universe stuff.
Absolutely.
And it's shot in a very noirish style as well, but also really hypnotic and real as well. Like, I mean, I'm not a 14-year-old girl.
Actually?
No, not anymore. But the... It feels real. It feels the way that she talks about, you know, and in the diary as well, her and Laura leave the boys and both just are crying the whole way home.
Mm.
You know, it just feels this raw kind of wanting to be part of the adult world, but kind of being freaked out by it and not having the emotional apparatus to deal with what's happening, you know, and process it. But also, but it's funny as well, because she talks about, I mean, obviously, the provocative element of it is her and Laura were very young. You know, she talks about being 13 or 14. But the thing that's funny, and this is a meta element, because obviously they always cast older actors, you know, you'll have 20-somethings playing teenagers. And she talks about these 20-year-old boys, and she talks about this scene from years ago and all that kind of stuff. But her character's not even 20 yet.
No.
So the boys she's talking about are still older than she is now, which is telling the story.
Yeah.
So if she was like 14, that would only have been 3 years ago. But she's talking about it like an adult, talking about something that happened in her childhood. And I know 3 years at that age is a long time, but it is a reminder of the disconnect, the sort of cognitive dissonance between...
And, you know, given that I once was a 14-year-old girl, I can definitely relate to that. You want to be seen as more grown up than you are.
Yeah.
I remember being with my best friend when I was 14 and loving getting attention off boys, especially older boys. It was like, you know, oh my gosh, they must think we're like 17.
Yeah.
You know, but you're so immature that you're not expecting anything to happen. It's that real naive, you know, if anything was to actually turn quite serious, you'd be traumatized.
Well, I mean, but again, that's the great thing about youth, is that when you're young, it's everything's about next. Whereas when you're older, everything's about again, you know?
Yeah.
But there's danger.
Or not again.
But there's danger there as well, you know, and that's something that you know has to be navigated. So we see Cooper and Truman approaching One-Eyed Jacks, and I love how loud the sound of the wind in the trees is during that scene. We're really reminded that they're outdoors and that they're out there in the wild as well.
Yeah,
and we see an owl as well, and Cooper looks sort of a bit freaked out because, of course, you know, he had that abstract warning from. The nether regions from Major
the
Briggs.
The nether regions.
that's what I'm going to call the Black Lodge from now on. I love the way that Truman takes out that security guard by squeezing his balls and then putting a squash ball in his mouth and gaffer taping him, but then using his head to open the door and then you walk going to One-Eyed Jackson, you know, Twin Peaks is, the colour coding of Twin Peaks is very red. Everybody's faces and you know, always look very red. But then you mean One-Eyed Jackson. It's just an explosion of rouge, you know.
Mm.
We go back to some sexy orchid talk with Donna, you know. Like,
oh, yeah.
What does this bit do?
Ooh, it's quite romantic.
Yeah. I like your orchids. Will you do me on them? was that the sound that the orchid was making?
It's like a lower lip. Ooh. Here's my lower lip.
No, I said sexy orchid talk.
Sexy. You know, I've got that bedroom talk down pat. I just sweep you off your feet.
Particularly, you must have the orchids. We see, they find Audrey. I like the way, how gentlemanly Cooper punches Blackie's sister. He goes for a gentle tap in the stomach, doesn't he? Just enough to incapacitate her, but not enough to, get him on any lists. We see Jean Reno kill Blackie. Using his kind of Wolverine dagger doohickey. He escapes, and we see somebody pull a gun on Truman and Cooper and the escaping Audrey, and then we get Hawks. It's a good job you guys can't keep a secret.
Yeah.
But I love the fact that he uses a machete as well. We see Hank.
I'm glad he didn't say anything about how he tracked them.
or turned up in full native regalia. Yeah.
Tomahawk.
We see Hank looking on, but he gets caught by Jean as well. So there's the web thickens there. Indeed. As well. But he's still got Lodwigs's wallet that he lifted from him in the diner.
Mm-hmm.
Always thinking ahead, you know, it's useful. That's a useful thing to have if you're in a tight spot. We see Donna and Maddie get caught.
Harold rake a thing down his face.
He says, are you looking for secrets? And the thing I've noticed in HD is you can see the stage blood on the forks.
Oh, before he's even done anything.
Before he's even done anything.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you see as he goes over, he accidentally taps his cheek and you can see a bit of it go
there's
on.
A little bit on there.
I've never noticed. I've never watched the show in quality high enough to actually notice that before. So that's an interesting little thing. Just the sheer, I mean, a TV show made in like 1990 was never intended to be seen in quality this high.
Oh, it didn't detract from me.
No, but it was. And I was kind of looking out for it because I've thought that effect has always looked a little, you can kind of tell how they're doing it. It's a bit like when you and I were watching Lord of the Rings.
I thought you were going to say when you and I were raking up.
Yeah. When you and I were watching Lord of the Rings the other day, and I was saying about how all the budget in the world, but they still do the sticking the sword between the body and the arm, shot from the side to look like somebody's getting stabbed.
It's classic for a reason.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that the putting the stage blood on the thing and then moving it along, that's just something that's just, it's as old as the hills.
Yeah.
Any final thoughts?
But if it ain't broke, why fix it?
Well, you know, exactly. Yeah. It works. Any final thoughts, Helen, before we wrap up?
Solid episode. Looking forward to the next one. Bring it on. Blah, blah, blah. What I say every time.
Okay, well.
Shall I tell you what it is?
I was going to do my...
Oh, sorry.
Should we do it the way we've done it 170 times instead? quick reminder that we appreciate feedback at rewatchprojectpodcast@gmail.com. And we are also on Instagram and Twitter at rewatchproj. Check out our friend shows and reviews on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. I also appreciate it. So what are we talking about next time, Hannah?
The next episode is called Demons. Synopsis says, James saves the girls from a tormented Harold.
Spoiler alert.
Cooper brings Audrey home. Bobby and Shelley learn that their insurance plans have backfired. Donna tries to convince Truman that Harold Smith has Laura's secret diary.
Alrighty.
It is directed by Leslie Linker Glatter and written by Harley Payton and Robert Engels.
Looking forward to that one. Okay, that's it for now, guys. We will
keep
see you
keep the feedback
soon.
Coming.
Absolutely. We would appreciate that. We're a whole damn town.
Indeed. We're a whole damn town.
See you soon. Bye-bye.